Welcome to History 320. I'm Addison Horton. Today, I will be discussing the founder of modern Jewish thought, Moses Mendelssohn. He has an incredibly impressive resume, but for our purposes today, we will have to narrow our scope to perhaps his most influential work, Jerusalem, or On Religious Power in Judaism. Although it is not without its faults, this book makes the assertion that Judaism and the modern nation-state do not need to be at odds with one another. He also makes the argument that Judaism is indeed a religion. Again, Mendelssohn's logic is not without holes. In fact, there are quite a few contradictions and inconsistencies that we will address. But the fact remains, Moses Mendelssohn continues to be an incredibly important figure in Jewish thought. Scholars continue to address his ideas, whether in affirmation or denial, and echoes of his principles continue to be heard in Jewish works published in recent history. All of this is to say, Moses Mendelssohn is relevant, and therefore he deserves the spotlight for a moment. As is true of most scholars, it is impossible to study Mendelssohn without first understanding the context in which he arose. He was born in Dachau, Germany in 1729, but by the age of 14, he had moved to Berlin with Rabbi David Frankel. This was his teacher of Ptolemaic studies. It is here that he studied the world's languages, along with mathematics, philosophy, and most importantly, logic. This was, after all, the Age of the Enlightenment. The Age of the Enlightenment is also sometimes referred to as the Age of Reason. This emphasis on logic seeps into Mendelssohn's writings, as it did most scholars at the time. Consider Baruch Spinoza, another early modern Jewish thinker. Although he predated Mendelssohn by about 100 years, arising on the scene early in the Enlightenment, he and Mendelssohn addressed certain topics rather similarly. This would not be striking had these men not have been incredibly different. Nonetheless, they both are characterized by their logical approach to Judaism, or, in other words, their attempts to justify Judaism using rationality. I would argue that Spinoza did a better job. Personally, I often joke that Mendelssohn was born in the wrong era. Logic holds him back, as I will explain later. He would have been far more free to pursue his convictions had he been born during the Jewish Renaissance.
Jewish historians see Mendelssohn as a major participant in the shaping of the modern Jewish world. As a man who contributed greatly to bringing the Jews of Europe out of the ghetto and into the mainstream of Western civilization.
What you just heard is a quote from Alan R. Kush, a professor of Judaic Studies and History at the State University of New York. In addition to the numerous books he has published, he is the translator of Mendelssohn's Jerusalem, and he is also the senior contributing editor of the Jewish Review of Books. His Moses Mendelssohn in the Enlightenment has greatly informed my understanding of this Enlightenment thinker. Arkush does not shy away from Mendelssohn's inconsistencies, but before we get to those, it is important to firmly establish, without leaving room for confusion or uncertainty, just how many wonderful things Mendelssohn accomplished for the Jewish people living in Europe. By just existing, living his day-to-day life among his intellectual peers, Mendelssohn proved to many Europeans that people like him, reasonable Jews, actually existed. Christian Judeophobia ran rather rampant in this community at this time. Mendelssohn's good friend, Gotthold Ephraim Lessing, a Christian, wrote his Nathan the Wise based on Mendelssohn. This work was rather shocking, as Jews were not typically displayed in such a positive light in the media. This friendship, according to Leora Botnitsky, symbolized the possibility of universal enlightenment. In Mendelssohn's work, he sought to convince both Jews and non-Jews that Judaism did not need to be isolated to the ghettos. Instead, Jews could assimilate into modern nation-states without surrendering their Jewish identity. He even translated the Hebrew Bible into German, representing a beautiful melding of the two cultures. In essence, Moses Mendelssohn was a mediator, connecting two groups, addressing both, giving insight and new perspectives to each. This is truly incredible. But after all, nobody is perfect, not even Moses Mendelssohn. However, where Mendelssohn errs is not due to a fracture in his belief. Rather, it is a disconnect between what he says he is trying to say and what he actually says. Mendelssohn's theology is beautiful and wondrous and awe-inspiring. This seeps through in his writing despite the fact that he is trying to stick to the facts. Again, this is not entirely his fault. Remember when he is living. Scientific, rational explanations are everything, and he's being asked to either convert to Christianity or disprove it. I'll note here that he gracefully avoids doing either, but he does point out that Christianity is built on Judaism, and if Judaism falls, it's taking Christianity with it. Nevertheless, Mendelssohn's goal in Jerusalem was to provide a viable and satisfactory philosophy of Judaism. Many scholars can acknowledge that he failed to do so. Consider Botnitsky again. In her How Judaism Became a Religion, she says,
Mendelssohn offers no philosophical or theological justification for why Jews should obey the law, and by virtue of his own definitions, he cannot provide any philosophical or theological justification for why Jews should obey the law, because he argues that Jewish law is temporal, historical truth whose legitimacy rests on neither the universally accessible dimensions of philosophical truth nor the dogmas of particular theological belief.
Now, Botnitsky is not suggesting that Mendelssohn's work is irrelevant on account of this. She is merely saying that Mendelssohn does not provide a solid reason for why Jews should obey the law according to philosophy or theology. This doesn't mean that they shouldn't, or even that Mendelssohn is wrong. He simply doesn't provide, again, a philosophical or theological reason. This is why Arkush comes back into the conversation. He suggests that Mendelssohn was entirely aware of these shortcomings in his work. In fact, he believes that Mendelssohn's true aim was to deflect the arguments he had been asked to respond to altogether. Arkush also suggests that Mendelssohn was trying to create a form of Judaism that was suitable to the modern times. In this way, he, along with others, could uphold their faith while also participating in the cultural and political aspects of an enlightened state.
And you, dear brothers and fellow men who follow the teachings of Jesus, should you find fault with us for doing what the founder of your religion did himself, and confirmed by his authority? Should you believe that you cannot love us in return as brothers and unite with us as citizens as long as we are outwardly distinguished from you by the ceremonial law? Do not eat with you, do not marry you, which as far as we can see the founder of your religion would neither have done himself or permitted us to do? If this should be and remain your true conviction, which we cannot suppose of Christian-minded men, if civil union cannot be obtained under any other condition than our departing from the laws that we still consider binding on us, then we are sincerely sorry to find it necessary to declare that we must rather do without civil union. Then that friend of mankind, Don, will have written in vain, and everything will remain in the melancholy condition in which it is now, or in which your love of mankind may think it proper to place it. It does not rest with us to yield on this matter, but it does rest with us, if we are honest, to love you, nevertheless, as brothers, and to beseech you, as brothers, to make our burdens as bearable as you can. Regard us, if not as brothers and fellow citizens, at least as fellow men and fellow inhabitants of the land. Show us ways and provide us with the means of becoming better men and better fellow inhabitants. Permit us to be partners in enjoying the rights of humanity as time and circumstances permit. Moses Mendelssohn to his Christian readers in Jerusalem.
Mendelssohn had a foot in each camp. He was Jewish, making him an other in European society, and he was a liberal participant in German academia. He wanted the two to be rectifiable, both for himself and his fellow Jews. This desire contributes to his call for religious freedom and the separation of church and state. Mendelssohn states, and I quote, "Neither church nor state has the right to subject men's principles and convictions to any coercion whatsoever. If this is accepted by both Christian Europeans and Jews alike, then Jews can participate openly and without barriers in the modern Enlightenment society. This is what he really wanted to bring about through his work. This is the point he was really trying to make in Jerusalem. Now, before we wrap up, I want to devote some time to the aspect of Mendelssohn that I see is the most resonant today, his perception of ceremonial law. Mendelssohn describes it as a kind of living script, rousing the mind and heart, full of meaning, never ceasing to inspire contemplation and to provide the occasion and opportunity for moral instruction. Now, I've read Martin Buber, Abraham Joshua Heschel, and Edmund Flagg. In all of their works, I feel Mendelssohn's presence. They might not reference him directly, but they discuss the practice of Judaism as Mendelssohn did, as if it is alive and beautiful. The ceremonial law serves a very similar purpose for each of these men. Martin Buber, in addition to his emphasis on encounter, asserts that Western Jews could learn a lot from Eastern Jews. He admires that Eastern Jews are visibly Jewish and obviously deeply connected to their culture. The implication is that Eastern Jews are more observant of ceremonial law. As such, they are able to engage with their Judaism on a deeper level. Heschel's The Sabbath is basically a love letter. He talks about this set-aside day of the week as if it were a bride. He explains that the other 6 days of the week are for ensuring that physical needs are met, while on the Sabbath, we especially care for the seeds of eternity planted in the soul. It's an absolutely beautiful sentiment. Heschel goes even further in describing it as the climax of living. I personally am not Jewish and have little experience with the Sabbath. For that reason, I was especially struck by one of my classmates' reactions to Heschel's work. Sam Gerber wrote, "During my Jewish education, I was always taught the notion that Shabbat was the successor to the week and a day to recharge our tired bodies. However, viewing it as the apex of our week rather than at the end makes Shabbat feel more significant and memorable to me. Not only is it a time for simply physical rest, it is a spiritual time that we try to become more attuned to the holiness in time rather than in the space which we reside in." Heschel did for Sam what Mendelssohn tried to do for his Jewish readers. He brought life, beauty, and meaning into ceremonial practices. Flagg also did something similar with his Why I Am Jewish. In response to his essay that outlines his journey away and back to Judaism, many people wrote letters to Flagg. One person said that this account reinvigorated Judaism for him. The writer mentioned how he had lost sight of the beauty and love of Judaism, and instead it had become a mindless practice. Flagg's new perspective, with its emphasis on love and unification, helped him to rediscover the joy that was available even in the repetition. If you take nothing else with you from today's episode, bear in mind that Mendelssohn was, and still is, a dominant figure in modern Jewish thought. His request that Jews be welcomed into Enlightenment civilization and his emphasis on the significance of ceremonial law marks him as an extraordinary thinker. You do not have to be Jewish to be inspired by the love and wonder that Mendelssohn writes with. He did have his weaknesses, but the true test of a scholar is whether one gets right more than he gets wrong. Mendelssohn does this, and he deserves every ounce of admiration that he receives.